Hello, this is Dean Gocher. I'm founder and director of the Institution for Authority Research. I encourage you to trust in the Lord with all your heart. Lean not to your own understanding. In all your ways, acknowledge Him. Then He's the one who directs your path. That's Proverbs 3, 5, and 6. And this program is about a process that's anathema, or actually the enemy, of Proverbs 3, 5, and 6. It is about a process I call diaprax, the dialectic process and the practice of it. Praxis is the Greek word for practice. And so we have today in our culture the practice of the second part of Proverbs 3, 5 is leaning to your own understanding. But the Word of God says we are to trust in the Lord with all our heart. See, that's with all your passion, with all your soul, with all of your identity and purpose, you're to trust in the Lord because He's the one who directs your steps. You know, the scriptures are very clear. It is not in man to direct his steps. God never gave us a microchip at the beginning of our lives showing us internally from nature itself, from the creation, on how to direct our steps. Everything in this world is temporal. All that's of the world, lust of the flesh, lust of the eyes, and the pride of life, is not from the Father, but is from the world. It's of the world. We're in the world, but we're not of the world. And so today I'm going to talk about paradigms. We've covered this subject over and over again. The dialectical process is a paradigm. A paradigm is a way of thinking. There are different ways of thinking. God says, my ways are not your ways, neither your thoughts my thoughts. As far as the heavens are higher than the earth, so are my ways higher than your ways, and my thoughts than your thoughts. In other words, my paradigm, my way of thinking, is not your paradigm, your way of thinking. Our way of thinking, our paradigm, is tied to the creation. God's paradigm, His way of thinking, He's the creator. And therein, there's a difference. He's above and we're below. So every time God speaks to us, it's in contrast. In other words, I am and you are not. In other words, I am God and you are not. And we find in the garden, Genesis 3, where God, actually 2 and all following, where God put Adam in an environment which carried an above-below paradigm. I'm above, you're below. And the one who's above is the one who is in authority. He has the power. And also the author. Author is the first part of authority. And so he authors commands. And he gave a command to Adam. Now there was a positive command, was you can eat of all the trees of the garden. A good deal. But then there was a negative command, and that was you can eat of all the trees, but you cannot eat of this tree. And so therefore, a negative came in. There was a limiting to what Adam or what man can do from the authority that's above. He's not only the authority, but the author. The authority means, again, the force. So he said, if you eat of it, the day you eat thereof, you will die. Now, that's a patriarchal paradigm. That's a top-down system. And today I want to look at one of the men who have helped change our nation. They call it a paradigm shift, but it's actually a paradigm change. Help change the nation in the way it thinks. I've covered several men. I've covered Theodore Adorno, Abraham Maslow, Carl Rogers, Irvin Yalom, and there are a whole cauldron of these social engineers that have had input in the changing of the way we think as a people, moving us away from setting our mind on things above to where now we set our mind upon things below. As I shared in a prior program, Carl Rogers said, before counseling, the person, he called them clients, will say, what would my parents say? Say, what would God say? What would that authority above me who authored commands into my life that I must obey, and if I disobey, then there's consequence, there's chastening, there's accountability to higher authority in that patriarchal paradigm. He says, but once I get you or your child into counseling, into this process, then they will begin to think, what does it mean to me? In other words, the above below is exchanged for me below. And the above is left out. And we find that in Genesis 3, 1 through 6, where Satan gets Eve to shift her paradigm. Because when he asked her a neurolinguistic sentence structure, yea hath God said, thou shalt not eat of every tree in the garden, that's an embedded statement in a question. And it's engineered in such a way that it is confusion. And what it does deliberately is to sensitize you to whatever it is in the environment that you were told that you could not relate with, that you naturally wanted to relate with. And the response from a neurolinguistic question, you know, I tell people the answers are in the questions. Whoever orchestrates the question, the way it's shaped, and there are different ways of shaping, you can shape questions that are didactic, a very facts-based question. And then you can shape a question to elicit feelings and opinions. And that's all Satan was doing. You notice he was tempting Jesus, but Jesus always responded with facts. It is written. With truth. It is written. It is written. It is written. In other words, Dad says, what my Father commands, that's what I do. He who does my Father's will in heaven is my brother, sister, mother. That's a patriarchal paradigm. But that question, that structure of question, elicits an opinion. An opinion is your personal opinion. And therein, she says, for God has said, thou shalt not eat of it, nor touch it. Your feelings are always incorporated in your opinion. Your thoughts are incorporated in your opinion. And so the paradigm shift was to move America away from accountability to higher authority, which were limited government. See, the legislators are accountable to the constituents. They were sent to represent the constituents' position. And that meant they had a conscience with science. Not see, science carries the very same language as God. True science does. Paul says avoid the oppositions of so-called science, not true science. He didn't say oppose true science, because there's antithesis in true science. He says avoid the oppositions, the Greek word is antithesis, of pseudonomous gnosis, so-called knowledge, so-called science. And what that is you incorporate feelings in that science. Now, if there is two and another two, and you add them, there is a four. But there's no feelings involved. There are no, your opinions really don't count. Now, if you incorporate your opinions in a fact such as 2 + 2 = 4, you would state it, I think 2 + 2 = 4. So you turn that which is certain, it's absolute, it is established, into uncertainty. In other words, now it's relative to your thoughts and your feelings. And that's, in essence, what the dialectical process does. That's what Satan did with Eve in the garden. He asked her for her opinion of God's word. Now, if you want to understand the megachurch today, the so-called Bible studies are actually men facilitators who, facilitation means to make change easy. Now, with God, dying to yourself is not easy. But this process says, oh, well, it's easy. It lies within you. This dissatisfaction to having to obey your parent or God or some higher authority that interferes with your natural inclination. I mean, if you were left to yourself, you would do something that some higher authority comes in and says you cannot do. And therein is dissatisfaction. You're not dissatisfied with what's in the environment you want to relate with. You're dissatisfied with the condition that you can't relate with it because some parent or God has told you you couldn't do what you naturally, your natural inclination, your internal desire wanted to do. And so the dialectic is actually a process in circumventing that, in creating a mindset where you're not in your own perception disobeying the parent or disobeying God. You're simply doing what is natural. Now, let me explain that. And I'm going to explain, I'm going to go through a lot of quotes from Eric Fromm. And there's a reason for this. But I want to lay, again, a foundation to work from. And that foundation, again, is the dialectical process. Now, anybody who's heard that word has probably studied Hegel or Nietzsche or Kierkegaard or Marx and, you know, and dialectical materialism and all kinds of different renditions of the dialectic with its thesis. Some people don't like to use thesis, antithesis, synthesis as a foundation because it's a process and they don't like the formula. And that's the transformational Marxist. Now, traditional Marxists would set the formula. There's a thesis, a position, in other words. There's an antithesis, an opposing position. And that would just simply mean this is right and that is not. And the other position would say, no, you're wrong and I'm right. Now, the feelings comes in that if you happen to like the other person or need the other person, say they're your boss, and you have a position and they have an opposing position, and your feelings are involved in a sense that if you challenge their position, insist yours is right, then they're going to affect your promotion or your salary, and that's going to hurt your feelings. So now relationship with the other person comes into the picture. And this is where the dialectical process begins. It's in that antithesis environment, which is not in true science, because true science is a not. It is or it is not. And E equals MC squared. And how Einstein came to that, he filled up a black rooms full of blackboards with this is this equals this is this is this is this and cannot be that. So you have to eliminate the cannots and find only the is's, and then you build truth on truth, and you come up eventually with the simplified truth. But it takes mathematically quite a bit of effort to come up with this outcome that is an is-not patriarchal, didactic, deductive, structured, or paradigm. The dialectic, though, is a deceptive process in that it incorporates feelings, which is human. You know, God told man, he says in Scripture, it is not good that man be alone. And therein is the relationship factor. Notice today everything is focusing on relationship, not position, not thesis, not knowing, not truth, but on feelings. And it's not enough to just follow feelings, because then you just go out and do, you know, whatever you feel like doing, and nothing ever gets done. Just pure eros. And no labor, no production, just mob rule. Now, for the dialectic, then, it is an objective of using these feelings to collectively bring people together to produce things in a relationship-based factor. It's not enough to have a skill to build a tractor or build something. It is the relationship you have with everybody who's involved with building whatever it is you're building. And so the human relationship factor must be incorporated in the outcome in a dialectical, heresiarchical paradigm. Now, the garden experience was the same pattern. It simply was Eve sharing her opinion because, again, in your opinion, you have this relationship, this feelings. She says, "For God has said, thou shalt not eat of it, nor touch it, lest ye die." And I've shared this over and over again, but it's important to understand. If we're going to do behavioral science, see, and Paul would call that so-called science, you have to look at a person's behavior based upon the incorporation of their feelings. And that feeling is incorporated or associated with dissatisfaction. Now, whenever something in the environment triggers a neuron in your body, a nerve's ending, and an impulse is sent up that nerve if you touch something. And between the contact with the environment, whether it's touch, taste, sight, smell, sound, and the brain, there is a gap called a synaptic gap. And a chemical is released at the the end of the neuron, and there are some 60 different neurotransmitters. These are just simply chemicals that are released and travel across that very small gap and then hit a receptor on the next neuron, the pre-neuron ending, and then the impulse, electrical impulse, deionized impulse, is then sent up into the brain. Where then there are, again, synaptic gaps and neurotransmitters are secreted, released, or emancipated into this synaptic gap, float across, hit the receptor, and then the messages then conveyed on into storage. In fact, in the brain, these are called dendrites. There are some 10,000 dendrites between each nerve. There are something like a billion neurons in your brain, and then in between them are all these connections. It's like a holograph when you remember things. It's not one spot in your brain. It's distributed across your brain. But where that information is stored, they're not quite sure yet, but they know it's stored in that dendrite or in the synaptic gap. And the chemical that I want to focus on, and it's the chemical of pleasure. And there are several of them. There's GABA, which happens to be with sleep. There's serotonin. Women have more problem with serotonin because they only produce about a third that men produce, and therein they become more depressed. And so there are some drugs out there you can take that are serotonin-oriented, or, you know, and they help get people out of depression. It's a chemical process. But the one I want to focus on is dopamine. Every habitual drug is tied to dopamine. Caffeine, tobacco, cocaine, methamphetamine, everything that when your body runs out of it, it wants more. It's crazy. It starts shaking. It's associated with this neurotransmitter, dopamine. So say you, and it's not just the artificially induced chemicals that you put in your body. It's the environment itself that stimulates dopamine emancipation or liberation into that synaptic gap as well. Say you touch something and that neuron's activated and it gets to the synaptic gap, dopamine is released and then hits the receptor, triggers the message up to the brain, and then when it is stored in memory or muscles are activated or several, you know, heightened awareness, dopamine is involved with that. And so your mind then, because it's chemical in your brain, but your mind, it goes into the direction of what produced the pleasure. That's natural to every man. We are created by God to approach pleasure. Now, there are other neurons that are tied to pain. And so we're designed to avoid pain. And there's adrenaline and other chemicals involved. And so you either fight it, you look at it first, you evaluate, you look into the environment, you know, how big is it? Will it hurt me? Or am I boxed up to in a corner where I better do something? And so you either fight it, or if you can get away, you flee. Fight or flight, it's called. Now, with the pleasure orientation, though, it is our mind then that looks into the environment, what produced this pleasure? Because I like it and I want more. And I share this over and over. The child, when you give them a toy, and I guarantee you get dopamine when you're in the store buying that toy, because in your mind, you're releasing dopamine. Have you ever had to do an assignment and it gets boring? You know, and what's happened is when you're learning stuff, dopamine's involved. And once you've gone down a road, the first time it's exciting, second time exciting, maybe the third still exciting. And as long as you're learning new information, that information's being stored in the brain, and dopamine's involved in the initial storing of information. But then when you go over the same thing over and over, dopamine is less involved. And eventually there is no dopamine, and so there is no pleasure. It's just memorizing. It's routine. And so it gets boring. And so you're doing your homework and you'd rather be doing something else where there's dopamine involved. Well, you can't, because there's the teacher, there's the author of the book, or, you know, the one who gives you the book, and then the authority. In other words, you want to avoid pain, right? And so they're the ones who can inflict pain upon you. Maybe not physical, but give you a bad grade and then goes home. And then the parents will inflict pain upon you, which, by the way, is a very patriarchal paradigm. Because Hebrews 13 says, God chastens those he loves. See, and so that's a traditional environment. You're chastened because there is right and wrong. And somebody's wanting to teach you what's right. And the body, the natural flesh, says, you know what, this is boring. I don't want, it doesn't relate to me. It doesn't produce excitement in me. It doesn't produce dopamine. I want flesh. See, the flesh is tied to the dopamine. There's the law of the flesh, and it's tied to dopamine. And so you're doing your homework, it's boring, and you look out the window and you begin to daydream. You imagine a world in such a way that dopamine is actually liberated in your body. And so this is you use either the imagination of your mind or the real environment to get more dopamine. We are physically engineered to approach pleasure. So when you're in that store buying that toy for your child, you're imagining, you know, them unwrapping it. You've seen them do it before. Isn't that exciting? And there's nothing wrong with that. Parents should take pleasure in giving their children, as God gives his children, things. Now, God's spirit, you know, he's not tied to the dopamine, but we are. But that's of the earth. That's what man, God formed man from the dust of the ground. That's where the dopamine is involved. But he also breathed the breath of life into the nostrils of man, and that's the spiritual part of man. That's not the dopamine part. Because, see, what God does with his prophets, he sends them into the desert to get them off the dopamine. But say, as parents, you want to your children to enjoy life, and God certainly does too. There's nothing wrong with a neurotransmitter such as dopamine that God has given us, or serotonin, or GABA, or any of these other neurotransmitters. It's when we love them. So you take that toy home and you give it to your child, and they tear their wrapping off, you know, to get to it, and they get it, and they are excited, and you're getting dopamine from that, and they're getting dopamine from that, and nothing wrong with that. You know, God has given us this creation. Anytime you smell bread, dopamine's involved. Anytime you look at a beautiful sunset, dopamine's involved. You know, somebody compliments you, dopamine's involved. You study the Word of God and you get new understanding. Not only is it spiritual, but dopamine is also involved. It's when you love that pleasure, when you love the creation over and above God, when you make it your object of worship. So you give that child a toy, and he's playing with it. Now, and you then tell him to put the toy aside because, you know, time to eat or time to clean your room or some project you've got for him to do, and he keeps playing with the toy. And what you then do is you have to chasten them. You know, warn them, give them stern warning. You know, if you don't do this, then this is what's going to happen. You know, consequence, cause and effect, is and not. This is right and that is not. If you do what's right, you'll be blessed. If you do what's wrong, if you do that which is not right, then you'll be cursed. There will be consequences. And so you're teaching them, a child, a very patriarchal paradigm. You're teaching them self-control and self-discipline. You're teaching them they have an office. They have an office just like you have an office. And as God has an office over man, he is the one who says this is right and that is not. And you as a parent are doing the same thing to your child, teaching them right from wrong. See, chastening produces a peaceful fruit of righteousness. Right. This is right. And so after the chastening, they know there is a right and there's wrong, and it's clear. There's no confusion. It's peaceful now. And so as you as a parent instruct your child, say they're continue to play, they're in love with this toy. By the way, they're not in love with the toy, they're in love with the dopamine. The toy stimulates. So, you know, it could be some, they might like one toy over another because it looks like dad's truck. So there's a lot of association involved with this because the mind is involved. But nevertheless, now, you have to then chasten them because you're instructing them that there's a higher authority and they're accountable to the higher authority. There is objective truth. It's not subjective anymore. It's not the environment, and it's not their brain and their thoughts upon the creation that gives them meaning and purpose in life. It's that higher authority above the creation, the creator, whether it's the parent or God, that gives them purpose and meaning in life. Now, that's not dialectic, see. The dialectic would consider that way of thinking anathema. That is the enemy, of humanism, is that patriarchal, didactic, deductive reasoning paradigm. So the child then is chastened, and you get the child off the drug. That's what it's all about. You know, it's grievous for a season, Hebrews 13. Well, why is it grievous? Because they're in love with the dopamine this toy is producing, and then you take the toy away, and you might have to do a little physical, you know, if you don't get control over your flesh, I will have to use control over your flesh. I'll have to inflict pain upon your flesh until you learn to discipline yourself, get in your office, control yourself as I control you. I don't have to control you anymore. You are maturing to control yourself. You have an office over yourself. Two-year-olds have an office over themselves. And so when you chasten your child, and it doesn't have to be physical, you know, it comes to a point, all you have to do is just look at them and say, you know, that's wrong. And that settles it. If they've learned self-control and self-discipline. Now, biblically, it's humble yourself and deny yourself. Because self loves the dopamine. Self loves the world. See, when you're thinking to yourself, it's what can I get out of this for me? You're looking in the environment, you love the dopamine, and say, how can I manipulate the environment so I can get some more dopamine? That's the world's friendship. That's the world's love. You know, they say, well, we love you. Well, they're hanging around because you happen to have some money, and you know, or every time you say something to them, you flatter them, and they like you around because they love the dopamine you're giving them, the compliments, the pride of life, and you're able to live off of them, off of their, wow, I like you, and that gives you dopamine. So it's just a drug-driven world. Now, see, when you're in chastening, it's getting you off the drug. It's withdrawal. And it produces a civil society. I have to be careful about that word civil, because see, civil rights is different than common. See, common sense and good sense. You know, even Bill Clinton would go to conferences and they'd have good sense behind. Now, if you read Antonio Gramsci, an Italian Marxist, it was all about good sense, which is dopamine oriented. You know, it makes everybody feel good. That's what consensus is, instead of common sense. Common sense is if you own a tractor and a neighbor wants to use it, you spend some common sense there. Now, if all his toys, you know, big grown-up adult toys, you know, cars and tractors or whatever, and you see him abusing them, everything he has is broken, and he's coming over to ask to use your tractor, common sense would say, no, sorry, you know, I like you, and, you know, in fact, I might go over and actually do whatever you want to do, but I'll do it instead because I want my tractor in good shape when I bring it back home. That's common sense, but it might not make him feel good. You're not concerned about him feeling good. You're concerned about keeping your tractor the way it is because you need it. It's production. Well, today, folks, see, we've gone to this good sense, this dopamine, make everybody feel good. That's what consensus means, with the sensuous. So when Satan confronted Eve and asked her for her opinion, and she says, for God has said, thou shalt not eat of it, nor touch it, there's the dopamine. There's the love of the world. And then she says, lest ye die. Remember, God said, don't eat of that tree, lest ye die. That's God's tree. And God is the author of all things. And he's saying, okay, you can have this, but you cannot have that. And Satan says, oh, you won't die. And she's instantly liberated from accountability to higher authority. Instantly, the paradigm has changed in her mind. And now she can look at the tree with no godly restraint. That's the dialectic. Why? Because the ought came out. I ought to be able to touch the tree. And I've gone through this over and over. You know, you tell your child you can't go up. There's you're the author. They say why to get you into dialogue, because there's the freedom of the dopamine. And you say, because I said so. And you just close the door again. And then they think to themselves, I ought to be able to go out. They're daydreaming. They're looking out the window. And they're trying to stimulate that dopamine again. And now they're bitter. They're dissatisfied with accountability at higher authority. And that's what Satan has to go after. He goes after your dissatisfaction to anything in this life. See, we're not to be ignorant of Satan's devices. He's subtle. He's cunning. He knows how to find that ought to be within you. We all have it. And he did it with Eve. I ought to be able to touch the tree. Lest ye die. And he says, oh, you won't die. And now she's free to think. Now her feelings are out. Her opinion is out. I can do this in the classroom and liberate every child in the community from accountability, higher authority to their parents. And then get them to think. Well, it's good for food, pleasing the eyes, desires to make one wise. Well, if you want to study this, you can get on my website, authorityresearch.com, and lots of articles on there. We're running out of time on this portion of the program, so we'll take a break here, and we'll be back in a minute or so.